Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The West has gone to great lengths to generate a false narrative about the conflict in Ukraine. The Kiev regime is losing, and badly so. And no amount of propaganda can alter this reality. This conflict will come to an end, and it will be on Moscow's terms. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, Glenn Diesen in Oslo. He's a professor at the University of Southeastern Norway, as well as author of the book Russophobia, Propaganda in International Politics. And here in Moscow, we have Xavier Moreau. He is the founder of the Center of Political Strategic Analysis, StratPol. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Okay, let's start out with Glenn in Oslo. Again, the media continues to churn out what I think a very warped impression of what's going on in Ukraine, the conflict there. But I find what's very curious, and I think it's really important to talk about, is that people that should know what they're talking about are essentially talking about how the West will influence the outcome as if they have any influence at all to enforce an outcome. Minsk 3. Now, to remind our audience here is that there were two agreements immediately after the coup in 2014, the two Donbass republics just said, look, we didn't vote for this guy, this new government. And so they left, and then there was essentially a civil war. Minsk 1 and 2 put that conflict into, you know, deep freeze. And it was a process in which the two Donbass republics would be reintegrated into Ukraine, though having a lot more autonomy. And it's being talked about again. I mean, it's if the last, you know, 3 months or so of conflict has not even happened. And why is it being talked about? And is it a way out, as we keep hearing? Zelensky will decide what victory looks like. Your thoughts, Glenn?
Well, I've been worrying about this for quite some time. And again, this is something that's well recorded through history, at least over the past 100 years, that when countries are in conflict, they tend to talk up the victories and downplay the losses to keep morale up. And this is something we see in this conflict as well. I mean, you have to present a narrative in which Russia's being defeated, because this is what's necessary to keep morale going within Ukraine, but it's also necessary in the West to make sure that the public keeps supporting, you know, and putting the economy on the line, and also continue to pump in these billions of dollars of weaponry, which, well, depletes the resources here, but also, you know, risks nuclear war. So there's a necessity to keep up this idea that there's winning. But of course, as also the literature is very clear, when finally reality catches up and it's evident that a loss is coming, it's very difficult to change the narrative. So this is where the stage we're at now, and we have to find a way of negotiating. How we have to start sitting down now and finding a peace with Russia. But how can this be done? And again, some people are now suggesting, well, let's go back to Russia's terms, what Russia asked for, you know, back in February before it intervened in this conflict. And this is problematic, because now we're talking about autonomy for Donbass. But of course, this is after all these rounds of escalation, this is far gone. And I don't think, well, obviously Russia, you know, it was happy under the Minsk agreement to give autonomy to Donbass, that this was kind of a compromise. It would solve the NATO question. It would also solve the internal Ukraine question. But again, that was 7 years of not happening. So the problem now was from February on, Russia recognized the independence of Donbass and then went on attack against Ukraine. And now, of course, it has been escalated over time. Now, in March, we had a possibility of a peace agreement, but this was then sabotaged, as Ukrainians also recognized, primarily by UK and US, in order to essentially weaken or bleed out the Russians. Now, this isn't working either. So this is the problem. Now, Donbass might not even be enough anymore, because what Russia recognized in the fight was a key problem is it needed civilian administration in the territories lost by Kyiv. But you can't have anyone volunteering locally to take over civilian administration if they risk retaliation if Russia would ever leave them. So Russia have to communicate clearly support that they would stay there and never leave. you know, so you've seen this by setting up national symbols, reorienting the internet, anything down to the currency use, to the, you know, having Russian license plate on the cars, as you see in Kherson, for example. So the problem is escalated to this point now that I don't think just Donbass is gone. I think Zaporozhye and Kherson is also gone. And again, this is something they have to take into account because it continues to escalate. If there's no peace agreement now, if one has to see what happens. Once Donbass is sold for the Russians, the rest will be kind of low-hanging fruit for Russia. So they can march very easily then once all these forces have been liberated from Donbass, that means Russian troops liberated from fighting and they're free to fight other places, then it will be very easy or easier to take Nikolaev, Odessa, even Kharkov. And at that point, Russia will not even negotiate this territory. So my point isn't, for many, especially on the Ukrainian side, this might seem unjust, but it's simply, do you accept now this territory is lost, or do you wait for 2 months and then have even more? And I think this is the dilemma. And it's quite unfortunate, obviously, and I can understand why many would be hesitant to negotiate on these unfavorable terms. But if the terms will only become more unfavorable, then surely this is a good reason to sit down and talk today.
You know, we all saw each other recently in St. Petersburg. We were sitting at the same table. There was a gentleman from India that had joined us. And Xavier, you and I got into a conversation with him, and he said that what was needed was a win-win solution. And I was really puzzled by that because why? Okay. I mean, what does that mean? The Minsk agreements were the win-win, as Glenn has pointed out. And the Ukrainian regime and its Western backers rejected it. So why go back to something that they rejected then when the facts on the ground have completely changed? Xavier.
Yes, actually, it's too late. Russia is winning the war. And if you remember, the Russian claims in the beginning of the operation was two things. Recognize Crimea as a part of Russia and recognize the independence of the republics. And they refuse it. So The war aims have changed already on the 22nd of April. The war aims officially are all the Ukraine coast and supposedly the Kharkov region as well. And it will happen. So it's over. But what is changing is that on the mainstream medias, for instance, I was reading CNN statement saying that Russia made progress because they took their mistakes in consideration. So, of course, it's not the same as it used to be. And I saw it on the French medias as well. And now the new narrative is, okay, Russia lost the war because they wanted to invade all Ukraine. I don't know where they found that, but actually that's what they say. And they just can only pretend to take the Donbass, maybe. But it's too late. It's too late. Russia won't negotiate again on a Minsk on a basis. It's quite impossible. The only thing that Kiev, if they start to be reasonable, can do is agree with the creation of Novorossiya. To be frankly speaking, and if they don't do that within a month, in my opinion, the war aims will change again. Let's talk about Cherkasy, let's talk about Poltava, let's talk about Chernigov, and let's talk about Kiev maybe again, because, you know, sooner or later, a treaty would have to be signed. And it maybe should have been signed already 4 months ago in Kiev.
It's really interesting to me, I mean, looking at the mainstream media, and that's what I do for a living, and particularly on this conflict here, Glenn, that there's still this kind of impression that the West has influence here, how to determine an outcome. And that is that is completely unreasonable to believe that, okay? And plus, and I don't want to harp on the Minsk Accords all the time, but that was an agreement. So why would the Russian side believe that their interlocutors this time? Because the last time, they didn't fulfill their side of the deal. So, I mean, the Ukrainians, at the behest of the West, the United States, and the UK, have really put themselves into a spot because there's just there's lack of trust completely. Glenn.
No, I agree. And I think that's a key obstacle to any compromise because it would have to be guaranteed somehow by hard power because trust doesn't exist anymore. And again, you're correct. That was a lesson from the Minsk II agreement because even Poroshenko spoke very openly, but now also many leading American officials have also said openly that that the Minsk agreement allowed them to prepare for war for 7 years. And, you know, and then, yeah, so that this simply it doesn't become a peace agreement. It becomes a temporary ceasefire to essentially rearm and then go back to the way things were, to fighting. So I think this is why I think Russia will be very hesitant to accept any deal. I mean, this is just reality, one in which they would have to fight later. Now, I agree, like the trust has kind of been lost on both sides. And of course, I think a key problem would be for Ukraine. Of course, they could have some legitimate fears that on unfavorable terms, Ukraine could be severely weakened, Russia could be strengthened, while the West would lose interest in Ukraine. And, you know, then they could risk disintegrating. So what they want are some solid security guarantees from NATO that they would intervene in a future conflict. But again, this is not going to happen. So, but one can see that, you know, that lack of trust and why they would want it. But you also have the side of the Russians, which is in any peace agreement, it could be, you know, it can be used to rearm Ukraine, you know, place more American weapon system closer to Russian borders, and even along the Black Sea coast, now that they've spoken so very enthusiastically about destroying Russia's Black Sea Navy, the Americans, that is. And, you know, so I think that one has to keep in mind that this is the main obstacle. Like, all sides want some kind of a security agreement. But this is why it goes back to why the conflict happened to begin with. This war began because European security architecture collapsed. This is why we're having these problems. So we have to address the real problems.
You know, Xavier, the real issue here, and again, mainstream media either doesn't have the intelligence and certainly doesn't have the integrity to discuss it. But just as Glenn said, I mean, this is all about Russia's security in Europe, okay? And because the West refused to interact with them and consider their demands here, Russia took the actions that it did. And because of that, and because of the lack of interaction, honest interaction with the West, they will determine when this thing is over and how far it goes. And there's not going to be any interaction or dialogue here because dialogue is a waste of time. We learned that from December 17th all the way to February 24th. Xavier.
Yeah, actually, no. For the Russian side, the West didn't respect his own signature. It happened the first time on the 21st of February when there was an agreement with Yanukovych to organize in 6 months a presidential election. This agreement, if I remember, hold less than 24 hours without any reaction from the West. After the weather...
Debbie, I have to jump in here. We have to go to a hard break. Okay. And after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. This is the home edition. To remind you, we're discussing some real news. Okay, let's go back to Xavier here in Moscow. We were talking about the lack of trust and broken agreements and how we ended up having this conflict. Continue on, please.
Yeah, and so they didn't respect the signature for Minsk 1, for Minsk 2, for the Steinmeier agreement we were supposed to allow to implement. This agreement, the OSCE as well didn't respect the basic rules because all the Ukrainian employees were organizing spying on the DNR and LNR territories. So it's impossible to trust the West. I mean, from the Russian side, and I can understand that. And the second point is there is another actor we have to take in consideration is the oligarchs. Because I'm sure that Kiev was planning to invade Donbas in March of 2022. I will not explain why, but maybe we can. But I'm sure of that. So, who organized this this operation? Who pushed to get this operation be done? It's the oligarchs because they lost many things during the first step of the Maidan operation.
The Ukrainian oligarchs.
Yes, yes. And for instance, Akhmetov. he lost already many many actives in the first part of the of this conflict in 2014-2015. He lost Mariupol, and he's about to lose Kryvyi Rih. And Kolomoisky is losing Dnipropetrovsk. And so all these oligarchs, we decided to push Zelensky to organize this military operation to get back their properties. They, of course, want to find an agreement, especially somebody like Akhmetov, because he perfectly understands that now Kryvyi Rih is 50 kilometers in the north of the front line. So it's the next step for Russia. And so he will lose everything after losing Mariupol, after losing Donetsk. It's over for him. So, of course, there is all these forces, the West, the oligarchs, who are in panic because they know that sooner or later, all these assets we were stolen during the 90s by the oligarchs, that we will get back to the Ukrainian people. And so that's a very... And consequently, the part we will stay in Ukraine will be the poorest one. Russia is about to take the port, the industry, the gas. For instance, 45% of the gas produced in Ukraine is in the Kharkov region, in 10 kilometers from the front line. If the Russians decide to go to Poltava, it will be 45% additional. So who will pay the bill? We will pay for weapons. It's not what we will have in Ukraine. It's something like a new Baltic country with a small population, no industry, almost no agriculture. So for the West, it's and for the oligarchs, it's panic because they use to steal the money in these territories, and they wouldn't do, they won't do be able to, they won't be able to do it again.
And let's go back to Glenn here, Glenn. And when all this is said and done, you know, one of the things that I always find interesting is from Western capitals about how this conflict should be resolved. Zelensky will decide it, okay? And then you hear murmurings, you know, the UK, Brussels, and Washington are working behind Zelensky's back to create, some kind of cessation of conflict, of hostilities under terms that they will decide, not Zelensky. We keep get these countervailing trends here. But one thing I'm very curious about, we never hear about, is that, well, when this conflict comes to an end, well, what about the sanctions? Okay, where sanctions are forever? I mean, that would go into anyone's calculus, all right? We look at the energy woes of Europe right now that are only going to get a lot worse as the year goes on. We all saw the Game of Thrones. Winter is coming, and they have not resolved that the issue of the dependence on Russian energy, even though what I find hysterically weird is that they know cut off all the energy from Russia, and then there's panicking about filling up their storage units for the winter. So that's kind of schizophrenic there. But I mean, what happens with the sanction regime? I mean, if there would be any influence the West would have, it would be about sanctions. And we know about when America passes sanctions, they never lift them. Glenn.
Yeah, and that's why, well, when you said before that the West maybe don't have that much influence over this, I disagree to some extent, because one of the things that Russia wants is obviously the removal of sanctions, but you are correct. To what extent is it possible? But also, would it be seen as a reliable or credible a bargaining chip? Because if they remove the sanctions today, even if it's possible, well, why not put it on next week? Because, you know, maybe the West get angered about something else. You know, it can be policies from Syria to, you know, gay rights. It doesn't matter. Like, the sanctions can come back right again. So I think that this is the main problem. Like, Russia, that's why this divorce now from the West, economic divorce, is seen to be somewhat permanent, because they want to insulate themselves from further sanctions. No, so I think that the sanction question is quite interesting. And also, it's the sanctions on Russian energy. I thought that was amazing, because Russia never actually had to do counter sanctions. Because, and this is great for Russia, because, you know, he wants to be a credible energy supplier. But it never had to threaten the energy because the West cut it themselves. So it kind of put sanctions on themselves. So this was an interesting move. But I think that if the West wants influence here in a peace agreement, the main thing it can do is to go to the heart of the matter. And this is to look at the issue of European security, because I'm often told here, and also by some Ukrainian friends, that they say, listen, Ukraine has reason to be fearful of Russia, and they want to go close to NATO. Fair enough. I can understand that. I think Ukraine has reasons to fear Russia. The West can have reason to fear Russia. However, Russia also has reasons to fear the West, that is NATO. And the problem is the security architecture of the past 30 years left out the second half, which is, yes, we have reason to fear Russia, but Russia can have no legitimate fear of NATO. If they hate NATO, they hate democracy. And this has kind of been the argument and become an entire ideology that it's like the biggest military alliance in the world constructed against Russia, openly speaking about containing Russia, that somehow this is not a threat to Russia. You know, and we even, you know, have to speak this language that is a defensive alliance, even when it invades other countries. So it's quite an extraordinary thing. So this is, goes to the heart of international relations, which is the security dilemma. One side should not expand security at the expense of the other. This was also the key focus of all the pan-European security agreements that we developed 30 years ago after the Cold War, which we've since abandoned. So I think if the West would go and offer something like this to Russia, that would be a bargaining chip, which might get some concessions out of Russia. But you're quite correct. Would Russia trust this? I think maybe they would be very skeptical, because over the past few years, the U.S. has demonstrated that it's prepared to withdraw from a lot of agreements, not just with Russia, but Iran and around the world as well. So the willingness of Russia to trust these agreements, I don't think it will be very high. But it's nonetheless important as a path forward to making sure that we can finally have some stability in Europe, because again, this is this conflict. I think everyone has an interest in it not continuing.
Exactly, and going back to our conversation the three of us had in St. Petersburg, is that the terms and conditions of ending this conflict. Russia has all the high cards, but part of its calculation is going to be to make sure that there isn't a repeat of this in 5 or 10 years, okay? And that's why, you know, it puts into question the statehood, the sovereignty of Ukraine completely, okay? Because we get not a peace settlement, but an armistice, let's say, and then, you know, for the next 5 years, NATO just pours in, you know, whatever's left of Ukraine, and they want to start it all over again. And NATO has an interest in doing that, because NATO has failed. It is failing, okay? And it cannot accept that for ideological and hubris reasons and everything else we usually talk about on this program. So part of the calculation from the Russian side is, you know, we're not going to do this in the next 5-10 years. I mean, we're going to make a settlement where we feel comfortable, and we don't really care what you think. Go ahead, Xavier.
Yeah, actually, if you look at the first Russian claims at the beginning of the conflict, it was denazification and delimitarization. So it means anywhere that at least there won't be any such sovereignty in Ukraine as it used to be. That means that Russia will strongly survey the militarization of Ukraine, the nazification of Ukraine. So on the point of view, on the Russian perspective, there is no more possible Ukrainian sovereignty as it used to be. And I just would like to add what you said before, that Russia needs sanctions. Because if you could look at, for instance, the planes industry for Russia. They just started investing on a base on a 4 years plan. So it means within 4 years, Russia don't have to get any Boeing, any Airbus on his fleet. So we observe exactly the same we observed in 2014, in 2015, that even if the West want to take back the sanctions, Russia will continue to adopt counter sanctions, because they can't trust the West anymore. And it's concerned, of course, the plants industry. It concerns the chip production, where they are now investing a huge amount of money because they want to be independent, using Chinese technology as well. But we have to understand that Russia needs sanctions. And in my opinion, since the beginning, when Vladimir Putin took the decision to start the special operation, he was thinking about that let's do what we did in 2014, 2015, 2016. It was quite difficult during these 3 years. But after 2017, everything was already okay. All the logistic movements now are reoriented toward Asia, toward India. And actually, in 3 months, it will be completely restructured. So sanction is a good thing for Russia.
Let me go to Glenn and finish off here. You know, Glenn, the Western narrative is that, you know, we have to push Russia out of Europe if it doesn't behave. But this is like, is what Xavier said. Well, Russia's been preparing to leave Europe ever since 2014 and survive those sanctions. It will survive these sanctions. It's not going to be a bed of roses. I always tell people this, the impact of the sanctions will be incremental. We will feel it over time, but there is a reorientation. Last 30 seconds to you, Glenn.
I agree. And Russia will feel a lot of economic pain later on. It will build up. But you're correct. This pain is seen to be instrumental in the process of decoupling a bit from the West. Not completely, but moving more of its economy towards the East. And that's what that's a benefit, if you will, from having the sanctions. It puts more motivation behind these pressures to, you know, shift away from Western industries, technologies, you know, transportation corridors, banks, currencies, and reorganize the economy closer to Asia. This is going to be very painful. Even small stuff like insurances on their ships, a lot of this has to be built up over time. So there will come a lot of economic pain to Russia, yeah, but in the long term, this will also hurt West.
Divorces are always messy. I want to thank my guests in Oslo and here in Moscow. I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk rules.